IVM.
Hello and welcome to the Habit Coach Podcast. I am Ashton Doctor, your habit coach. So today we're going to be talking about supplements. Now, supplements are something that I absolutely love. I am totally pro taking supplements. I've been taking supplements for years, and there's a reason why I take supplements. And you know, whenever I discuss supplements with people, it always turns into, no, why are you taking so much? What is it that, you know, there's so many mysteries around supplements and why we should be taking them or not taking them and what do they mean for us? So today, we're going to be deep diving into supplements and understanding what is the difference between supplements and medicines and supplements and all the other things that are available in the market today. So with me today, I have Akshay Pai, who's going to be discussing this and we're going to completely geek out on supplements and nutrition. So please stay tuned. Akshay, welcome to the Habit Coach Podcast.
Thanks a lot, Ashton. Happy to be here.
So excited. Akshay, tell us a little bit about you and your company.
The company that I've started is called Nutrova. And our goal at Nutrova is to develop evidence-based supplements that allow people to take charge of their health. The objective with doing this is to have products that actually give you a measurable outcome. And what we believe is that of all the things in our control, nutrition has the single largest impact on our health. And if we are proactive about that, if we sort of proactively address gaps in the food that we eat, in our diets, there's a lot that we can do, not just in preventing disease, but also in optimizing the overall quality of our life and help us move towards our health goals, whatever they may be. I mean, everyone's health goals are going to be different. But we believe that supplements can help us work towards our specific goals.
So how did you think of starting a supplement company? Like, you know, there's so many other opportunities that were there in, for example, nutrition. Why did you focus on supplementation in particular?
So my background is, so after starting biotech and I was working in pharma for a bit, and what was clear is that, you know, with pharmaceuticals, you know that there's, like you're sick and you need to take something to fix that. After that, within the same company, I'd spent some time working on diagnostics as well. So that's one step back, you know, try and catch it before it's a problem so that you can do something about it so that you don't need the pharmaceutical. And then when you actually take that thought process one step further, most of the diseases that we face today, I mean, again, with the exception of COVID, we're not going to count the last 12 months in this argument, but with the exception of the pandemic, infectious diseases have been on the downward trend, whereas lifestyle diseases are just escalating everywhere you go. Now, like I said earlier, nutrition heavily influences your risk of getting any lifestyle disease. I mean, diabetes, heart disease, and even some cancers, there's a clear correlation with how you eat and how you live in general. So the thought process was, can we get into this space in a way that gives you measurable outcomes? Because, you know, I mentioned that a couple of times, and the reason for that is there are a lot of supplement products out there. But for a consumer, now, if the goal is to get it prescribed by a physician, then that's that you're already sick. No one's going to a doctor saying, hey, can you check if anything's wrong with me? You know, they're going to a doctor when something's already bothering them. But if we want consumers to actually take charge of their health, the goal in our minds, at least, is to give them something that gives them a measurable outcome, as opposed to, you know, just taking a shot in the dark and approaching it in that traditional way that people look at supplements, in that, okay, nothing bad will happen. It's okay. You know, looking at it as an insurance where if as long as nothing bad happens, there's no cost to taking it. And that's, you know, half of it. The other half is if you get the right dose, get the right quantity, get the right form of a particular nutrient, why settle for nothing going wrong when you can have great things happening to your health? And yeah, and we realized that there was a gap over there. There weren't too many companies that were actually doing the research, doing the clinical studies on products that are accessible to consumers. Normally, the research goes more into the sort of pharma-oriented supplements or in the context of doses that are pharmacologically relevant. And there was this huge gap over there. And we knew that, okay, fine, maybe the mass market is not really looking for that kind of information. But we knew, I mean, everyone on the team is using our products. And, you know, we knew that there is a segment of people that wants the evidence, that wants the data. And there was no one giving it to them. So that was the thought process.
It's very interesting what you said, because there's so much to unpack. The first thing that I've taken out from this is to understand that you know, the whole concept of supplements versus going to a doctor are very, very different things. Right? Like you said, you go to a doctor when you're sick. Right? You already have something wrong with you, which is why you're going to a doctor. So that is what the role of medicines are. And that is what the role of pharma has typically been for all these years. Right? Then you mentioned two very interesting things, which was that we typically have our supplements because we don't want anything bad to happen to us. Right? Array, I have deficiencies, right. So I'm taking it. Array, if I don't take this, I'll feel low energy. If I take this, right? Vitamin C has suddenly boosted in these last few months, right? Because we're all saying, I don't want anything bad to happen in my immunity. And you said, oh, well, because all throughout, at least over the last few years, I've noticed that taking supplementation is not about not bad things happening, but how do you feel super duper good, right? How do you start feeling even more energetic than you ever thought you could? How do you actually start having vitality in your body? Making sure nothing goes wrong is one aspect, but how do you become, you know, plus plus is what I've seen supplements being used for. And are there certain supplements that you've noticed that do that and certain supplements that are just basic that everyone should be taking? Like, what is the difference?
So the way we look at it as a company, and this sort of defines a new product development process, we try to think about addressing the needs of a specific population and seeing if we can do better than the status quo that exists today. Let's take a deficiency as a basic example because everyone's going to understand that. Now, for a number of reasons, most of the Indian population, at least in urban centers, has less than ideal level of vitamin D3 in their systems. Now, the way to address that is through a really high dose. And it normally, when that's diagnosed, it's going to be during a health checkup or you're experiencing some kind of symptoms where a doctor tells you to get this test done. We can't do better than that. We can't improve the quality of something that's out there. But if you look at something that, again, just sticking to this because it's the easiest concept to understand, protein supplementation. Now, if there, again, there's no dearth of protein supplements in the market. But one common issue that we saw with a bunch of people taking protein supplements, including myself, the story behind this product is I got the R&D to make it for me personally because nothing that I was buying was working for me. And then a few people tried it and we started actually made it into a product that we sell. But what we found was a lot of people get bloated after taking a whey protein supplement. Now, when you drill down into that, the reason that happens is primarily because of the lactose in whey. And secondly, a lot of people react to artificial sweeteners, but that's a very minor effect. So the thought process was, can we develop a whey protein with negligible levels of lactose? And that's what we work towards doing. And the interesting thing is, this is not new information. About 60% of North Indians and about 75-80% of South Indians have varying degrees of lactose intolerance. And this is a fact. This is a proven, like an established fact by the National Institute of Nutrition, published data, all of that. But yet, where intentionally putting lactose into our system and making ourselves feel uncomfortable when we don't have to. You know, you get the upside of protein in the context of fitness, but then you're also getting this digestive distress, which you absolutely don't need. So that's the way we approach it, that we think about a group whose problems we can address and strive to try and get that right. Now, because we don't have sweeteners in our product, because of the grade of protein that we're using, it may not be of interest or accessible to everyone. But there is a very, you know, high intent set of consumers that know what they want. And we've decided to sort of focus on them and try and get to different, go from population to population. Now, on a supplement that everyone should be taking, I think that's incredibly subjective. So we try to look at it as, like I said, as a group of people. So if we're talking about, so one thing that I think generally applies to most groups of people is an omega-3 supplement. I think that's something that a lot of us need to be getting more of in our diets. And that actually opens up into a pretty interesting discussion. You know, like you mentioned earlier, the conflict between supplements and medicines and the perception rather of supplements being medicines. And omega-3 is a prime example of that. Just in brief, and just tell me if I'm going off track too much, but just in brief, with omega-3 and omega-6, they have incredibly important roles in the body, and we need to get them from the food we eat.
We need to get both. That is important.
Both.
It is not that,
absolutely important.
It is not that one is bad, one is good. We need both.
Absolutely. And what they do is they regulate, I mean, this is a bit of an oversimplification, but they regulate inflammation. And omega-6 works towards things that promote inflammation, whereas omega-3 works towards balancing that off by reducing inflammation. And so a very simple example is that when you pop a paracetamol for a fever, what that's doing is shutting down the production of something in your body that comes from an omega-6. The omega-6 starts a cascade which leads to prostaglandin E2, which is blocked by, I mean, needs an enzyme which is blocked by paracetamol. So it's not that inflammation is bad. You need inflammation. Your immune system functions based on inflammation through your body. All of these things are good. But the issue arises when the balance between omega-3 and omega-6 is off, because the, and again, just oversimplifying it a bit, but the enzymes required to get the omega-3 and omega-6 to do their job are the same. So if there's too much omega-6, those enzymes are focused more on converting omega-6 into things. Whereas if, you know, and so the ratio you want to strive towards is a 1:4 ratio of omega-3 to omega-6. And traditionally, and, you know, going back maybe 80, 100 years, actually before that, it's interesting to think about where we get these nutrients from. And for most of us, these are coming through seeds and seed oils. So nuts, seeds, and the cooking oils that we use. There's some quantities in fruits and vegetables as well, but those are negligible. They're also found in animal products, because animals also, like meat and egg, they also have omega-3 and omega-6 in them by way of the animals from which they're derived actually eating the foods that give them omega-3 and omega-6. So we need to get this from our diet. And what happened historically is our diets kind of rotated through the year based on what was available. So cooking oils is a prime example of this. Traditionally in India, cooking oils vary by season. You'll go from mustard oil to sesame oil to coconut oil to ghee to whatever. And each one of these has different ratios of omega-3 to omega-6. And so over the course of a year, you kind of balance things out. But what's happening now with most of us cooking in refined oil of some kind, whether it's sunflower oil or olive oil or whatever it is, that ratio is incredibly skewed. So if we aren't proactively adding omega-3 to our diets, it's a little difficult to get that balance right. And again, these are, instead of thinking about it in terms of like exactly how many grams or milligrams you need, just broadly speaking, if we're getting a lot of omega-6, we should be compensating with a sufficient amount of omega-3. So the interesting thing is now all health bodies across the world recommend getting 2 to 3 servings of fatty fish a week to make sure you're getting enough omega-3. With vegetarians, obviously, that's not an option. But just for the sake of this example, sticking to this recommendation of fish. Which fish? How are you going to cook it? How much is needed for getting that balance right? And how much is needed to optimize your specific health goals? Now, if you're going and lifting heavy weights 5 days a week, you're going to have marginally higher inflammation than someone who's not. So, and again, that's not bad, but it's something that needs to be addressed. So when we think about fish and fish, you know, eating fish is a prime example where if you deep fry fish, which I guess is everyone who eats fish's favorite, there's about an 85% loss of omega-3 in the fish that you're eating. Whereas if you're steaming it, it's only about a 10 to 15% loss. So all those things, who's going to sit and keep track of? You know, it's just easier, in our opinion at least, to quantify the dose you're taking and make sure you're taking it regularly.
Correct. And also farmed fish will have far lesser omega-3s than as the omega-6 ratios, right?
Yeah, it all depends on the feed and how they're farmed and where they're farmed. Because the fish also, they don't make their own omega-3. The fish get their omega-3 from the algae they eat.
Algae, correct.
And yeah, so, you know, addressing this in the context of vegans, not too many people, at least in the Indian context, are getting a lot of seaweed or algae into their diets. And so if they're taking out dairy entirely, which brings you some element of omega-3 and omega-6, depending on where it's from, they depend entirely on vegan sources of omega-3, which is, you know, things like flaxseed and chia, which are great sources. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But the form of omega-3 that is actually utilized by your body are the long chain ones, DHA and EPA. And for the form of omega-3 that's found in nuts and seeds to be converted to that is hugely inefficient. It's so DHA is the omega-3 that's in your brain, in your eyes, in your nerves. So about 1% and sometimes even less of the omega-3 from plants gets converted into DHA. And so that's something to just be aware of. And you can, of course, increase the intake of those seeds like flax and chia and figure out what the right balance is. But that's going to be a lot of trial and error. And in our opinion, it's easier to, if that's not possible, if that's not something you can do daily consistently, it's easier to get a pill that tells you exactly how much is in it and take that on a regular basis.
You know, I loved your answer because it was exactly the next question that I was going to ask you, which is that, you know, so many people write in saying that why should we take supplements? Our grandparents never took supplements. They were eating and they were so healthy and all of that. What was the difference between a few centuries ago and the kind of food that we're getting now?
So, you know, the oils are a prime example. You go into any kitchen today, the primary source of cooking, unless someone is proactively doing something about it, is going to be a refined seed oil, like a refined sunflower oil or refined safflower oil, something like that. And it's not that it's, so that whole refining process, what does it mean? What's being done is to, so oils go rancid. Oils are really susceptible to oxidation and they go bad. So when you refine them, you increase their shelf life. And a simple way to think about the chemistry is that the more omega-6 the oil has, the more shelf stable it's going to be. The more omega-3 it has, the more faster it's going to go bad. It's a simple way. It's not 100% accurate. That's a simple way of thinking it through. So here we have these oils that are being refined to make them shelf stable and removing the things that spoil fast, which is essentially omega-3 fats. And we're consuming them. That's pretty much part and parcel of everyone's life. And again, it's not a bad thing, but it needs to be looked at in the context of making sure you get the omega-3 to balance that out.
What are the other nutrients?
The other things that have changed, I think the consumption of grains for sure, the profile of grains that are consumed. There's no rotation of grains. You know, if we're eating... So what happens with the rotation of grains is that you're also, each grain has its own profile of micronutrients, of vitamins and minerals. And there's this really interesting anecdote actually. So when I wanted to get into the whole nutrition space, the initial thought process was to get into malnutrition as we think about it in the rural context, where there's micronutrient malnutrition on account of not having access to those things. So I was speaking to this lady who runs an NGO in rural Maharashtra and asked her her opinion. And she just said, what are you going to standardize for? Because in the area that I work, it's drought stricken through the year. And the only thing that grows here is ragi. And these people are out through the day. And so they're getting their sunlight and nachni is loaded with calcium. So calcium is not a problem here. But you try and address someone similar living in Mumbai, for example. Calcium is probably going to be more of a concern than say a vitamin C, which these people in this rural area didn't have access to because nothing fresh is growing there. So just by virtue of eating seasonally, these things tended to balance themselves up on average. Of course, if there's a lack of access issue or something like that, then of course that's not going to be addressed. But on average, these things kind of worked out. But when we look at the way we eat today, it's we have access to everything all the time. So preferences tend to drive the way we eat rather than, you know, the seasons or just nature in general.
So well, it's so interesting you said that because we are eating basis taste or we're eating basis what is available around us. You're not thinking about what it is doing to our body. Like I keep telling people that, you know, you have to start thinking about what is it doing to your body. Every time you put something inside your mouth, somewhere it is going and affecting something. Right? Either you're moving towards health or away from health. And everyone's obsessed with carbs, proteins, fats, right? Our macronutrients. Tell us a little bit about our micronutrients. Like what is the difference between vitamins and minerals, for example? Like how should people start bucketing these?
So as far as vitamins and minerals are concerned, vitamins are essentially nutrients that our body cannot make. Our body can't make minerals either. But minerals are a little easier to understand because that's your iron, calcium, magnesium, you know, chromium, copper, zinc, those sorts of things, which our body needs in really tiny quantities, but they're essential to the functioning of certain critical processes. Calcium and phosphorus, for example, also play a role in joint. I mean, our bones are essentially made out of calcium and phosphorus. Vitamins are cofactors for our body. Like there's everything in our body is done by enzymes, and vitamins bind to certain enzymes and allow them to do their job. So for example, vitamin C, its main function in the body, it's an antioxidant, all those things are great, but its main function in the body, without which is where the problems start if you don't have enough vitamin C, is in the production of collagen. So collagen is the most abundant protein in our body. It's present in our skin. About 60-65% of our skin is essentially collagen. It's one protein. And it's in our joints, in our hair follicles, across all over the place. And if you don't have vitamin C in your diet, the enzyme that makes collagen can't do its job. So I don't know if you remember in school, you know, when they introduced us to vitamins in school, they mentioned this story about how people on long voyages, sea voyages, would get scurvy. And then suddenly someone started carrying oranges and the scurvy went away. That's basically what it is. Scurvy is a lack of vitamin C. And so you start losing the ability to produce collagen. And it starts showing in your gums initially because your teeth start falling out and stuff. That's what they had showed us in those textbooks in school. But yeah, so when we look at bucketing these things, with vitamins, we want to make sure that we're getting enough. With the exception of vitamin D, our body, it needs to get this from the food we eat. And I think, you know, the vitamin discussion becomes a little interesting, particularly about what you said about how, you know, the general perception is that we need to focus on things like carbs and protein and fats. This another thing that we're trying to sort of address through the information we put out is that our body is a system. It's not, you know, if you change one thing in the system, something else is going to change as well. It's not that, okay, I'm not going to eat carbs right now, so linear relationship, I'll lose weight, for example. If you think about an average Indian, okay, an average Indian diet, if you're cutting out carbs, what you're essentially doing is you're cutting out your primary source of B vitamins. For vegetarians, you're cutting out your primary source of protein, because for a lot of vegetarians, the grains they eat are their primary source of protein. And you're also cutting out your primary source of a lot of minerals, like zinc and magnesium, for example. So we need to look at these things overall, that if you'll survive without carbohydrates, but you won't survive very well without vitamins. So we need to look at vitamins in that context, that ideally, if we can get them through our diet, great. But for certain things that we might be a little prone to, and this is where the individuality comes in, someone who is a strict vegan, for example, is unlikely to get sufficient B12 through their diet, vitamin B12. And similarly, they're also unlikely to get iodine through their diet. Now, you take a strict vegan who's only having pink Himalayan salt, they're definitely not getting iodine through their diet, because your primary source in India is the iodized salt. So when we think about vitamins and minerals, it's important to contextualize it to your individual needs, because there's things that can be optimized and can be tweaked. But when we look at things as, okay, I'm going to cut out carbs, or I'm going to go keto and all those things, fine, great, it's serving your purpose, but just understand what is being lost in the process. I think that's a little important to understand. Yeah, and as far as bucketing is concerned, so with vitamins, you have your fat-soluble and water-soluble vitamins. That's the general way that they're classified, where A, D, E, and K are your fat-soluble, and the B vitamins and vitamin C are water-soluble. The general thought process has been, you know, have as many of the B and Cs as you want, because you'll flush them out. They'll come out in your urine and you can't really store them. Whereas A, D, E, and K are stored in the fat in your body. And that's obviously true. But when we look at that a level deeper, if it's someone who's really, you know, focused on, say, bodybuilding or fitness and has really low body fat, where are those fat-soluble vitamins being stored? Conversely, if you're sweating a lot, for example, if whatever activity you're doing involves you sweating a lot, there's loss of certain primarily minerals through your sweat, but it can also have an impact on some of your B and C vitamins. So do you need to overcompensate for that? Then you add the additional sort of complication of things like with the B vitamins, there's a delicate balance between some of them. So B12, folic acid, and B6, they balance each other out. So there's a feedback inhibition. If you have too much of one, it brings down the levels of the other. So do you want to be taking a hyperdose of one particular vitamin, not knowing the impact it's going to have on everything else within your body? So those sorts of things, I think they're very individual. And how should somebody
figure this out, right? Because like if we want to demystify nutrition and these kind of supplements, how should people even start thinking about what is the right dosage, what is the right thing? Because that is the main concern. Like, I don't know enough. And it is too much for people to research.
Absolutely, absolutely. I think the first step is to identify what your specific goals are and sort of introspect a bit on how you're eating. All of us would like to believe we have a balanced diet, but balance is incredibly subjective. So there's certain things that you'll need for your specific health goals. And making sure that you're getting those things is the first step. When you're talking about vitamins and minerals, this is my opinion, and as a company is also something that we follow, that in the absence of an acute need, like say someone has a deficiency, don't exceed RDAs. Don't exceed recommended daily allowances of micronutrients. Because that's when things get out of hand. The good thing is, in the Indian context, the supplements are regulated by the Food Safety and Standards Authority. And what they've done, this becomes a bit of a roadblock when we're trying to develop products. But overall, for consumers, I think it's a good thing where if you want to put vitamins above the RDA, you need to make a case for it, or it's regulated as a drug. You can't sell it as a food supplement. So there's that first check over there. And the RDA is, so with supplements, there's the RDA, which is a recommended daily allowance. The next level beyond that is the TUL, which is the tolerable upper limit. That's a level that has been proven to be tolerable for the population at large. Beyond that, you have this other level called the NOAEL, which is the no observed adverse effect level. And then the LOAEL, which is the lowest observed adverse effect level. So that would be the level at which the problems start. And that's like, for most nutrients, it's, you know, a factor of 10 or 100 more than the RDA. So making sure you don't go too overboard. So again, first step.
It sounds like it's difficult to go overboard because you'll have to take lots of capsules of that particular thing in order to go overboard on it.
Yeah, yeah. But that's Indian regulation. You can still get products from overseas and, you know, cross those thresholds. So I think the first step is identify what the gaps are in your particular diet.
And buy local for supplements as well.
I mean, yeah, as a supplement company in India, I would strongly advise that.
But, buy local veggies, buy local supplements. Okay, loving it.
Yeah. So so once that first step is done, where you identify the gaps in your diet and you realize that there's certain things you want to add that will help you work towards your goals, getting those nutrients in either by changing your diet or by supplementing would be the way to go. And the other thing, one thing I think it's more of a mental thing rather than an actual task to do, is expecting immediate results. I mean, nutrition is something that does its job over time. And products that have research behind them, and that's one of the reasons that we spend so much of our time and energy towards this research, is, I mean, they will talk about it. They're doing a clinical study, they will put that information out there. So generally, a product that's accessible to a consumer, a food supplement, will have the information supporting the claim that it's making, the function it's supposed to be serving. I think that's something that consumers can look out for. And again, keeping in mind that these things take time. You know, it's actually really funny when we're thinking through this. So one area of focus for us is collagen supplements. And we have a product which we did the first of its kind clinical study on that was published in the UK-based Journal of Cosmetic Dermatology. Basically, what collagen does, long story short, is, and what our product was demonstrated to do, is improve skin health it improves the barrier. It makes the collagen in your skin better and it repairs damage, essentially. That's the short version. And so when we have these discussions where, why does your product take 60 days to give a result? Or why does it take 30 days? Our results came after 30 and 60 days in the study. And you would think it's intuitive that if, say, you start using the supplement at the age of 30, you have 29.99 years of damage that's happened to your skin. And you wanted to go away in less than 30 days. You know, so that contextualization is also important as a consumer. And like you said, you know, early on, that vitamin C has suddenly become like the focus ingredient since the pandemic started. It's not going to magically prevent you from getting sick. It's a good thing to have, but it's not some magic cure-all that's going to prevent you from falling sick. So setting the context, setting expectations, I think that's also really important when you're choosing what product to use. And for the most part, as per the law, you have to list the ingredients. you have to mention the quantities on the labels. So if consumers just look out for that, I think it's not as complicated as, I'm making it sound right now.
Before going ahead, we'll take a quick break. And we are back. What should you be aware about in the ingredient labels?
So,
like, are there a few things that are immediate red flags? Do not buy this brand or do not buy this particular product.
So I think it boils down to what a consumer's expectation is. So if we're talking about proteins, for example, now if I know that I don't deal with milk very well, I don't want to be consuming a whey protein supplement that is a whey protein concentrate, because that's going to have higher levels of lactose than a whey protein isolate. Sticking to the example of collagen, if you realize that you want to supplement with collagen peptides, probably make sure that your product has collagen peptides. Because we're seeing this a lot right now where there's this, flood of veg collagen products in the market. And veg collagen doesn't exist. So if you've decided you want collagen peptides, then probably stick to a collagen supplement. And so I think that's the first step. Make sure that the product that you're going to be taking has what you want and in the quantity that you want. So omega-3s are another thing that... you want a certain amount going in. You want, say, 100 mg or 500 mg or 1,000 mg. Make sure that your product has that in that quantity. And the labels need to mention how many servings you need to take to get that quantity. So a lot of times we see, that's another thing, that question we get asked, that why is your dose so high? The other one is one capsule. You're telling me to take this entire sachet of 10 grams. You look at the number of servings to get the effective dose, it's like 10 capsules a day. If you're cool doing that, sure, by all means do it. But yeah, so,
too much cellulose.
See, cellulose is just going to go out of you. It's not going to dramatically change anything, but it's just a convenience thing because, nutrition works over time. And if you aren't able to do something every day, you're not going to get the maximum benefit out of it. Yeah, so for a consumer, making sure that, so first identifying the nutrient that they would like to add to their program, finding a product that gives them that nutrient at a dose that they need, or they've been told that they need, or they believe that they need. It's better to start lower rather than higher, because you don't want to, so it's hard. Like I said, it's hard to go too high with the Indian regulation. But if you're using products that are imported, it's best to just keep in mind, 1,000% RDA sounds like more is better, but it's not necessarily the case. Maybe in some contexts, but not always. And setting the context, so making sure that you can do it over time. The other thing that you can, so as per regulation, you need to mention if there's any potential allergens, if all the ingredients, whatever they may be. So just reading the ingredient label carefully, I think, is something that a lot of people should do.
Any chemicals to avoid when you think about supplements?
So again, because of the way the laws are in India, there is a defined list of what you can and cannot put into a product. And you cannot deviate from that list without express approval from the regulators. So it sets what additives are allowed. It sets what sweeteners, flavor, like everything. It just defines exactly what is allowed and what's not. So it's, and again, this isn't a pitch to buy local, but it's easier. It's very hard for you to get something that you don't want through supplements that are made here that are following the rules. And of course, if there's something, if there is a case where someone is adding something to a product where it's not, it shouldn't be there, I very seriously doubt they'll advertise that on the label. So, so it's best to stick to focus on brands where there is an element of credibility, where either someone's recommended it to you or they're being forward with their research, they're sharing information. And for the most part, at least with brands that have come up in the last decade or so, everyone's open to share information and everyone's accessible. If you have a question, if there's something you have a doubt about, just reach out to them on social media. I mean, everyone's accessible nowadays. I don't think that should be a concern. And because of that access, there's also that accountability. Because, if we do something that's wrong, it's there for everyone to see.
Interesting. Akshay, last question on this. We have supplements, and then we have these natural herbal compounds like ginseng, for example, or ashwagandha, or those kind of supplements as well, right? We have hardcore vitamin D, omega-3, those kind. And then we have these herbs as well. Now, what is the difference? How should the listeners think about these two categories of supplements?
So it started off with the Ayurvedic supplements that have a history of doing really good things. But let me give you an example from an ingredient that we work with that will tie in with the stuff that was said earlier. So this is an ingredient called lycopene, which is it's a carotenoid, an antioxidant that basically makes tomatoes red. So any red fruit or vegetable that you eat, it's because of the lycopene. So watermelon, guava, all of those things. Lycopene is incredibly good for your skin, for sure. It prevents UV damage on a cellular level, but it's also good for your circulation. And so it's got a bunch of benefits. Now, the problem with lycopene is that you don't get 100% pure lycopene from a natural source because you're extracting it from something. It won't be 100% pure. When we're saying that a product contains lycopene and there's an effective dose of 5 milligrams, is it 5 milligrams of lycopene or 5 milligrams of the extract? And is that an actual extract or is it 5 milligrams of just like tomato powder? That's where things can get a little gray with botanical supplements. So most players in this space will mention on the label how much of something that is. So
the active ingredient in that.
Yeah, the active ingredient. So so for example, you look at the example of the 500 mg vitamin C products that are rampant online. Now, 500 mg of vitamin C, the RDA, as per the National Institute of Nutrition, is 80 mg. Sorry. Now, 80 mg and 500 mg, and you know, like I said earlier, if it's 500 mg, it has to be regulated as a drug. But yet we have these food supplements out there. So if you turn around the labels on those and have a look at them, in most cases, it will be an amla extract or a rosehip extract or something like that. And again, not to say that these are bad, but just understand that it's not 500 mg of vitamin C, it's 500 mg of the extract. So most companies will mention it's a 10% extract or a 20% extract or 40, 50, 80, whatever. So you have an idea of exactly what's in it. So if it's an ashwagandha or something like that, 500 mg of ashwagandha, is that 500 mg of actual ashwagandha powdered and put into the capsule? Or of the extract that's actually going to give you, you know, the effect that you're looking for. And I think that is more of a ties back into the labeling and asking for this information if you have a doubt.
Okay, lovely. So I think one of the big takeaways from this is that we need to start at least some form of supplementation because, you know, like we were discussing earlier, there are nutritional deficiencies that we have because of the way that we eat. And we need to figure out what these nutritional deficiencies are for each of us. And figure out what is it that we need to start taking. In fact, in our next episode, we're going to be discussing this and deep diving into various supplements that we feel that, you know, are essential for people to take and talk about them. So it is important for us to realize that, one, supplements are not medicine. So do not think of them and treat them as that. Two, like you said, it's very, very hard to try and overdose on a supplement, right? It's very, very hard to get possibly sick from it because of taking too much of it. So keep that in mind as well. And I think the last thing, at least from my side, is start experimenting with supplements. Start becoming comfortable with them and looking at different ones. I remember when I first bought my protein powder years ago, the first protein powder that I had bought, this was way before anyone was really working out and, you know, having our protein supplements. Everyone told me, Ashtin, be careful, don't have too much. Your kidneys will fail, your liver will fail, your this will happen, your that will happen. And it is a constant barrage of, you know, be careful, be careful, be careful that was there. And now I think over the course of time, what you realize is that you can maximize your food to the extent where it's going to be, you know, the healthiest that you can possibly be eating or the most variety that you can possibly be eating. But you need to have that supplement to just take care of stuff that is not necessarily coming in from your food even then. And that is something that is a problem with our modern day world as well. So getting our supplements in, very, very important. Sorry, you were going to say something.
Yeah, I just wanted to add something to that. I completely agree with what you're saying. And, you know, taking that a step further, this protein example resonates because I've been hearing that for a very long time as well. And one part is making sure you're getting enough. But if you have the option to dramatically improve the quality of your life just by adding these nutrients to it, I think everyone should actually evaluate that. And it's not like it's suddenly magically going to make you feel better or protect you from COVID or something like that. It's, can it A, accelerate you towards your specific goals, or B, can it make what you're doing more efficient? My favorite example of this is, I don't know if you ever come across this, I'm sure you have, but there was this Go Mad diet that used to do the rounds in this hardcore bodybuilding forums, where basically what it stood for is gallon of milk a day.
Okay, no, I have not heard this one before.
So these, in the powerlifting and bodybuilding, that if someone is a hard gainer, if they have trouble putting on weight and muscle, they recommend drinking a gallon of milk every single day. And that's 100, 120 grams of protein, 200 grams of carbs, and about 200, 250 grams of fat. So 3,500 calories, essentially. Do you want to be doing that? Because it's not going to feel nice. And if there's a more efficient way to achieve that, why would you still choose to put your body through this? Because there's a cost associated to that as well, right? With the calories and with, you're just going to feel gross more than anything else. Drinking 4 liters of milk a day is not going to feel good. And I understand if it's a professional athlete doing this under the oversight of, you know, someone who knows what they're doing. But for the average person who's got an office job, taking in 3,500 extra calories a day it's probably going to damage your kidney and liver faster than anything else.
Yeah, and the amount you'd be sitting on the loo, especially if you're lactose intolerant, kalas.
Yeah, that kidney thing also, you know, another thing that's actually, that might help cap off this conversation is that a lot of the thought process and beliefs regarding supplementation comes from sick people. So very high dose of protein for someone whose kidneys are anyway not great, yeah, it's going to shut down your kidneys. But for an average healthy person, getting 25 grams of protein from whey protein or from a steak, it's the same thing. Your body can't tell the difference. So protein is protein. Once it's inside your system, protein is protein. It's more effort for your body to break down the meat, and it's less effort for your body to absorb the whey. But aside from that, it's not saying that, no, I'm going to go damage the liver because this has come in through a supplement. Even with micronutrients, the hyperdosing, a lot of it comes from the belief that if you have low levels of biotin, you will have issues with your hair. Well, that doesn't conversely mean if you put 10,000% of the RDA on a daily basis, you'll have good hair. You know, so that nuance, I think, is also something to consider. So there's the deficiencies, there's the optimization and the efficiency. Like, how can we efficiently work towards our specific goals?
Very, very interesting. I love discussing supplements. We could possibly go on forever discussing this. Thank you so much, Akshay, for, you know, joining us on the Habit Coach podcast. How can people get in touch with you or learn more about your brand?
So our brand, Nutrova, we're on Instagram, on Facebook, and you can check out our website, nutrova.com. All the ways that to get in touch with us are there, whether it's, you can call us, message us, all that information's on the website. And yeah, if anyone's got any questions, we're happy to help you think this through. And share some of the research. That we put front and center. It's all over our website.
Perfect. Lovely. Thank you, Akshay.
Yeah. Thanks.
So start these habits and share with us your progress using the hashtag TheHabitCoach. If you like this podcast, don't forget to check out other interesting podcasts on the IVM network. You can listen to us on the IVM Podcast app or ivmpodcast.com. You can also follow us on social media. We are at IVM Podcasts on Twitter and Instagram. If you want to reach out to me, I am Ashtin Doc on Twitter and Instagram. You can find lots more information on my website, awesome180.com, or check out different content on my YouTube channel called AWESOME 180. That's Awesome 180.